Well, good morning, everyone. It's very good to see you all. Thank you for coming and joining us for worship today. We're going to continue this morning this series on worship. And last week, Nick Lunn spoke, and I haven't had a chance to listen to it. It's been quite a busy week, but I can imagine he spoke with his customary clarity and insight. And he was focusing, at least in part, on the fact that worship is a sacrifice of our whole lives to God. And of course that's true. That's the wider context of worship. And without that being true, then the act of worship just becomes hypocrisy, doesn't it? It just becomes, you know, as I think Amos said, these people worship me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me, speaking this prophecy from God. So if the wider context of our lives is not worship, then coming on a Sunday and singing songs is at best meaningless and at worst actually offensive to God, isn't it? But today I do want to focus in on that act of worship. That's what we're going to be thinking about for a little while. Now, this slide that you can't see, I now find, which is very disappointing because I'm really keen on this slide. What it's meant to show is the sun and planets revolving around the sun. And for years I've had this picture in my mind when I think of worship. That worship, the act of worship, is where we come and get our lives into orbit around God. And because I think the minute you step out of devotion to God, whether that's personal or corporate like this, you know, the world is bashing you about and knocking you out of orbit around God. And that's why intentional devotion to God, both individually in your own life and corporately, is so important. When I was a young lad, I thought church was pretty boring. And really, as soon as I had the freedom to make the choice to stop going to church, I stopped. And in my mind, this is what was going on. I accepted the ethical teaching of Christianity. I basically thought that the ethics of Christianity were good. This is quite a widespread view in our culture, by the way. But I wasn't entirely sure I believed it. And worse, I really didn't, you know, I could think of 100 things I'd rather do than sort of hang around with a load of older people in church, doing things that seemed to appeal much more to older people than to me. And what I found, however, when I embarked on this experiment of trying to be a good person without paying God any attention, is that my moral life deteriorated. And there was a crisis when I was about 21, and I realized I wasn't a very nice person at all. And that was really the beginning of me taking the Christian life seriously. Because actually, if you're out of touch with God, this is Christian teaching, you simply won't be able to lead the moral life that you would want to. And when we come to worship, whether, as I say, individually, and I think there's a place for both, or in a congregation like this, then I think it's quite a good image to think what we're trying to do is get our lives back into order around God. And when we're in that nice orbit around God, then we're living with the grain of the universe rather than against it. So let's just think about this act of worship. I've been a minister nearly 25 years. In September, I'll have been a minister for 25 years. And I think I've talked more about the act of worship than about any other single issue with people who are coming usually to complain. And usually they're complaining because the way in which that act of worship has been conducted in some way or another does not meet their expectations. So let me talk you through some different aspects of the way people might either have to approach worship or choose to approach worship. So first of all, and I think perhaps most tellingly, next slide please. Imagine this. Imagine you live in North Korea and you're a Christian and you're arrested for your faith and you're taken from your family and you're in a detention center. This will be happening today. And let's imagine that you don't know any other Christians in that detention center, and you'd be taking your life in your hands if you spoke about Jesus to anyone, and you're aware it's Sunday. And you're aware from the scriptures that Sunday is the Lord's Day. And so quietly, when no one's looking, you close your eyes and you whisper a prayer in the quietness of your mind and say, God, I can't worship, I can't sing, I can't talk to anyone else. And I've got to be dead careful no one spots me even praying. But thank you for sending Jesus to die for me. Please could you help me out because my life's a bit terrible. Is that authentic worship? It might be the most authentic worship anyone's offering, right, today. Next slide, please. These are two of my best friends, Liam and Katie Eaglestone. We named our daughter Katie after this lady that's on the screen. They live up in Liverpool, and I love them very much. Liam has all sorts of excellent qualities, but he can't sing a note. I mean, he has the anti-gift of singing. You don't want to stand next to him in church. In fact, he won't sing in church because he knows it's just, well, he knows it's just going to totally, you know, stuff you up if you're sitting next to him. You know, have you ever sat next to somebody in church who's completely tone deaf and singing vigorously? You end up thinking, is it me or is it this person? You kind of lose your bearings after a while, don't you? Liam cannot sing. I mean, he really is very, very bad at singing. So what's he supposed to do in church during a block of worship? Is his worship less effective because he can't sing? I mean, that's obviously a stupid question, but it is difficult when the main way we do it is singing, right? Katie, on the other hand, has got a fantastic voice, and she leads worship in church. And when they were just going out with each other before they got married, this was a source of quite a lot of good humour. Liam is quite mischievous, and he discovered that he could whistle and Katie couldn't. So he took to whistling in church, and then would say things when he was leaving, like, I didn't feel any freedom in my whistling today, and stuff like that. So Liam and Katie, is Katie's worship more valuable because she can sing beautifully? No, of course not. But what if you had a whole church full of Liams? I'm not saying that that's you. Okay, next slide. It's not you. I'm only joking. Now, how about Colin? See, Colin is a person. There's a few Colins around in churches. Colin loves classical music. He's a very fine musician. Plays the piano. And he could talk to you endlessly about the history of music. He's passionate about it. He could tell you some of the most beautiful pieces of music that have been written to the glory of God centuries ago. And he would say, if he was honest with you, and if he was at a bit of a low point, he would say this: why do we have to sing this banal, sentimental, three-chord rubbish in church when we have got a whole history of centuries of the most beautiful music that's been written to the glory of God, and you settle for this lowbrow stuff, appealing? You know, C.S. Lewis referred to what we do in church as rhythmic shouting. Why not sing something really beautiful? In fact, I think C.S. Lewis was not in favour of congregational singing. On this point, I disagree with him. Don't disagree with him on much. He was a pretty good guy, but he would take the view, if you want to honour God, just get the people who can. No room for Liam singing in C.S. Lewis's point of view. Just the Katies. Because it's got to be beautiful. It's for God, right? Now, I've exaggerated it, but there are certainly some Collins around in terms of the impulse in their heart. But much more common, I should imagine, amongst us, next slide, please, is those who prefer some form of contemporary music. I've gone for Oasis here just because there might be somebody, let's say, for sake of argument, Mark Hum, some of you know who he is, who would say they're his favourite band. Now, if Colin is leading worship every week, it is highly unlikely that Mark is going to enjoy it, because this would be his natural style. And, of course, next slide, please. That's just two that we could compare with each other. On there might be the style of music that actually feels most natural for you. Or maybe even you just don't like music. There are people who don't. So there's all sorts of different styles. And then it gets even more challenging to try. How on earth will God organise worship in heaven with all of us lot there? I mean, presumably it'll be good for everyone. How's he going to manage that? I don't know. Next slide, please. It gets even more complicated now, because then we've got our spiritual approach to worship. Now, I would think this would be, this is just a picture I ripped off the internet of let's say broadly, heartfelt, charismatic worship, whatever you want. What religion, worship of the heart. And there'll be lots of us here who'd say, that's the heart of worship, when people are responding and there's some degree of passion and emotion on display. That's when I know people are worshipping, when I can see the tears rolling down their face and their emotional reactions. That's worship. And if you're in a church where everyone's standing in straight lines, standing up straight, that's not worship. You know, God overwhelms us. If you're truly encountering him, surely there will be a reaction. And then conversely, another person comes into the conversation. Let's call him John. And John might say this: the God of heaven is not honoured by people's sentimental reactions. And I'm a bit dubious about it, because the people who seem to be reacting most emotionally in church, show me the quality of your worship by how you live. And by the way, did you leave your brain in a bucket on the way? I'm sure John MacArthur wouldn't say this. I'm sort of driving him to an extreme. Did you leave your brain in a bucket on the way in? You know, he might quote Ecclesiastes and say, don't come into the congregation babbling like a fool. God takes no pleasure in the worship of fools. Instead, be silent. Reverence. He is in heaven and you're on earth. Now, who's right? I've had both these views regularly put to me as a pastor. And my feeling is there's truth in both of it. But when you sit squarely in one camp and judge the other, no good. Actually, we should be worshipping with the whole of our personality, of course. Next slide, please. Then I was thinking about worship. I was thinking, you know, here's Stuart Townend. Now, you know, if you're brought up in my kind, if you've been hanging around my sort of end of the market of Christianity, you could substitute someone else for him. But I suppose 20 years ago, he was doing his peak business as a worship leader. He'd written In Christ Alone, which is still one of the most popular Christian songs according to when they do polls. And, you know, probably he was regularly leading thousands upon thousands of people in worship. But his star has faded somewhat, as is inevitable. And there are others probably these days who are more popular than him. I wonder, I mean, whenever I've had very brief conversations once or twice with him, and he's always struck me as a pretty godly bloke, actually, but I wonder if there's a part of him that kind of feels a bit jilted. And I wonder if you've served as a worship, in the worship band or whatever, for years and years and years, and then somebody else comes and takes your place. It's going to happen to everyone, isn't it? Might you feel a bit jilted? They don't do it like I did it. Next slide, please. And then you think of a young person who's maybe trying to find their way in the midst of all of this and trying to lead, you know, just is passionate about God and feels a desire to pick up his instrument and lead other people in worship with probably a whole bag of mixed motives, because who hasn't got them? And they lead worship and it's in this context. How on earth are they supposed to negotiate all of this? Now, I would say this to you all. I think this church is fairly mature about all of this. And actually, I've had less challenges here than I've had in some other churches. But I think all of us, if we're honest, could recognize some of these thoughts and impulses in us. And yet we have to come to worship and something has to be done, and it might meet with your approval and it might not. What does Jesus have to say into all of these thoughts and feelings and convictions that we might have? Well, I'm going to refer you to the occasion that he talked with a Samaritan woman. And if you know the passage well, in John 4, you will know that Jesus engages this woman and he crosses all sorts of cultural boundaries to just talk to her. It's a big risk just to talk to her. But he shows love for her, he shows interest in her life. And he actually asks her to help him. Next slide, please. And he asks her for some water. And then he says this thing about, oh, if you knew who you were talking to, you'd ask me for water. And it wouldn't be normal water. It would be water, spiritual water. You'd never thirst again. And she's a bit confused by that. And Jesus elucidates and says, this water will be a spring of water welling up to eternal life. And the woman says, give me that water. It's probably her conversion. John sees that. That's her moment where she reaches out to Jesus and says, yeah, I want it. And Jesus immediately puts his finger on her lifestyle. So here we see something about lifestyle worship. And we see something that you see throughout the scriptures, that as soon as you begin to encounter God, the very first thing that's going to happen is he's going to start to put his finger on your life and say, what's going on in your life? So he says to her, go and fetch your husband. And she says, well, I haven't got a husband. And Jesus says, yeah, you're right. The fact is you've had five husbands. And the man you have now, you now have is not your husband. What you've said is quite true. Now, that is brutal, don't you think? He's only just met this woman. But this is what God does. When we begin to encounter him, on one level we meet with amazing love, this boundary-crossing love. And at the same time, he intrudes straight into the space where perhaps you feel most vulnerable, where you feel you've failed, where you're messed up, and God wants to start to get to grips with that. He's like a surgeon. You know, you go to the doctor's nice and welcoming to you if he or she's got a good bedside manner, but then they'll say, now what seems to be the problem? And at that point, they want to know how to help you. Jesus is like that surgeon. He goes straight for the wound. She, however, is not ready to talk turkey about her woundedness. And I'm guessing it's true of counsellors, from the counsellors I've spoken to, psychotherapists. They start talking to people. They might have to go through a bit of small talk and stuff like that. Eventually, you get probably 5 minutes from the end of the session to the actual issue. And you start talking about it, or perhaps you're a counsellor and it's not getting to the issue and you have to ask a pointed question. And quite often what you get then is deflection. I'm not comfortable talking about that, so I'll try and deflect the conversation off at a tangent. That's what the woman does. She asks a question about proper worship. She says, I can see that you're a prophet because you know things about me you couldn't have known without revelation. So answer me this, she says. Us Samaritans worship in a particular location. You Jews worship in Jerusalem. Who's right? Now, she's raised an enormous kind of theological controversy of the day about the nature of authentic worship. Where? We wouldn't ask that question. We'd ask different questions, perhaps, about what makes for authentic worship. They ask the question, where? And Jesus is not indifferent to her question. He says, essentially, the Jews have got this right. But actually, he says, the day is coming, and he's referring to his cross and the resurrection and the ascension and the installation, the inauguration of the kingdom and the new creation. He says, in that day, that issue will become irrelevant. And instead, what will be relevant? Well, let's read. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshippers must worship in the spirit and in truth. And that was Jesus' holy and powerful word to her about worship. Next slide, please. We're going to learn four simple things. What makes for authentic worship? Firstly, particularly, and now I'm talking about the act of worship when we come together with other Christians. First thing we notice here is the emphasis on God as Father. And that is central to our worship. To authentic Christian worship is the grasp that God is your Father, but as the Lord's Prayer says, he is our Father. He loves you and he loves me and we're his children together. Sometimes on a Friday night in our family, we decide We were all sitting around when the four of us are all at home together, and a discussion, some kind of discussion. We normally have takeaway on a Friday evening. I look forward to that. And the takeaway is there. We're serving it out, and someone will say, "What shall we watch on the television?" And that's difficult, right? Because there is almost no item on the television that you could possibly watch that all four of us are going to like. And so we've got a choice, really. Either we're going to say, and this does happen sometimes, because I'm not saying we're a perfect family, we're certainly not, right? Sometimes what happens is we're all sat there eating takeaway in the same room, we're all looking at individual devices. Does that happen in your family too? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're much better than us. That's not really ideal, is it? We all might be individually enjoying ourselves, but we're not having any communion together. Sometimes, you know, they're mature enough to realise that my choice would be the best one for everybody, right? And they have that level of maturity, but sometimes they're just frankly rebellious and they can't see the wisdom in that. Now, assuming that's the case, and I'm their father, and I say I'm there with the two kids, do you think really I care what we watch? Well, because I'm not a perfect father, the truth is, yes, I do. But I think God's better than me. I don't think God would particularly care what was watched. He would care that there was love in the family. God is our Father. Now, the heart of true worship is the Spirit-inspired revelation that God is our Father. And so we celebrate him as our loving Father. But what we don't do is fall into the trap of individualism, thinking that the way I relate to him as Father is the way everybody else should, and then go on a campaign to make everybody else relate to God like I do. That is, frankly, immaturity. Next slide. And God is Spirit. And there's a lot of debate about why Jesus said this and what he meant when he said it. But I think in all likelihood, given the context, that what Jesus means is the externals are not really what is important. What is important is what's going on in here and what's going on in here. The authenticity of our lives, what we're doing with our hands, the authenticity of our relationship with him. So, you know, it doesn't matter what songs you sing, if your heart's not right with God, it's just a pretense. And if your heart is right with God, it doesn't matter if you can't sing a note. Jesus is saying, we wouldn't argue about the location of worship, that wouldn't matter to us, but the style. Let me tell you as a pastor, people definitely argue about that. And I think Jesus would say, do you know what? I'm interested in your friendship with me, with the Father. I'm interested in the authenticity of the way that you respond to me. And I'm interested in the way you relate to each other. And if all of that is in sync, your worship will be pleasing to me. And if it's not, none of the rest of it matters. So, how to have authentic worship? Jesus says then, given that that God is our Father and that he is Spirit, then we need to be those who worship in spirit and in truth. In the Spirit and in truth. So, here's my best attempt to give some guidance to authentic corporate worship. And to your own worship as you develop your prayer life and your personal devotion to God. The first thing, let's think about the Spirit and the truth in terms of how I relate to God. First of all, our worship must be in the truth. And I think by that what it means is perhaps two things. Firstly, it must be true to Christian doctrine. Not all attempts at worship are authentic if they are based upon misunderstandings of who God is, or a failure to appreciate who God is, We are called to worship the God revealed by Jesus Christ and the apostles in the scriptures. That's the God we worship. If we start playing fast and loose with that doctrine, there comes a point at which we're no longer worshipping that God, we're worshipping a God of our own imagining. So it must be in the truth, it must be in accordance with authentic Christian teaching. And secondly, it must be in accordance in particular with the gospel. Because it's only through the gospel that we have any possibility of genuine worship. Because the first thing that's going to happen when you come into the presence of a holy God is you're going to be convicted of the fact that you yourself are not holy if you're having an authentic experience with him. We see that again and again in the scriptures. But it is into that space that the gospel comes with a message of hope. You can be forgiven. And at that point, grace is mediated to you. So authentic Christian worship must have as its wider context an authentic understanding of the Christian gospel and authentic understanding of the teaching of the church. You don't have to know every last thing about God, because there'd be no hope for any of us. None of us know every last thing about God. But a basic understanding of God as revealed by Jesus Christ, that's what it means to be worshipping in the truth. Secondly, there must be personal authenticity to your worship. So your worship must stem from something that's true about you inside. Otherwise, again, we just fall into, these people worship with me with my lips, but their hearts are far from me. So there must be authenticity, spirit and truth. It must be spirit-inspired worship that is based on the truth and a true encounter with God revealed in Jesus Christ, mediated through the Spirit. Secondly, I want to suggest you should be authentic to yourself. Each one of us has a slightly different relationship with God. And the way in which you perceive God and relate to him will be reliant on all sorts of issues. Obviously, your personality that he's given you will be part of it. Your experience, your education, the kind of church you grew up in, all these things will have impact the way that you understand God and the way it's natural for you to worship him. The worst thing you could do, actually it's not the worst thing, a bad thing to do would be to get enamored by the way someone else relates to God and copy them. That would be a bad idea, generally speaking. That's not to say you can't take inspiration from people, but don't try and copy the way someone else relates to God. God made you, you. He gave you your particular Christian experience, cultural experience, personality, all the rest of it. The very worst thing you could do is assume the way you relate to God is better than other people and start pressuring them to relate to God as you do. Now, for me, when I'm in church and worshiping, if something strikes me, if I feel God speaking to me, my natural reaction is to sit down and reflect on it. I don't want to lose that. Now, I'm not saying that's all I'll ever do. God might touch me in all sorts of ways. But that would be my natural reaction, and there's nothing wrong with that. Equally, other people I've noticed, their natural reaction is to get very emotional and excited. Nothing wrong with that either. But, of course, if we want to, we can have a real falling out about it. And I can judge them as shallow and, you know, flaky, and they can view me as sort of stunted and repressed. But that is to make windows into people's hearts. That's God's business, not ours. Be authentic to who you are and the way God has led you and made you. Always be open to the fact he may want to reveal something new to you. Thirdly, an authentic act of worship, particularly if you're a mature Christian, is focused on making sure that in the midst of your relationship with God, you're being a blessing to those around you. Don't so insist on your freedoms to be who you want to be that you become a difficulty to those around you. And particularly if you've been in the faith a good length of time, your concern should primarily be for the generation that's coming up. I think one of the saddest things is when I see older folk who are trying to drag the church back to something they felt was great in the past. It may have been really great. But in doing that, you will stunt the possibility for younger people to encounter God. So it needs to be humility. A final word. Broadly, I'm in favour of our Sunday worship being fairly lowbrow, not highbrow. I'll tell you why. I think it's a very good theological reason for it. When Jesus came, highbrow or lowbrow? The New Testament was written in Greek. There were two forms of written Greek. Common Greek and the sort of Greek of the, I guess, the philosophers, like the posh Greek. New Testament, all written in common Greek. Jesus did not come to teach people to be educated and highbrow. Nothing wrong with being educated, nothing wrong with being highbrow. But the gospel is generally mediated through the culture of the common people. And so it's a challenge for those of us who by nature are highly educated and have a tendency towards highbrow culture to surrender that, actually. Because the most important thing is that the gospel is received by the masses. That's my theological conviction. God bless you. Let's be those who worship in spirit and truth, authentic to God, authentic to the gospel, in the spirit. Let's be those who worship in a way which is not a pretend, it's not trying to copy anyone else, but the actual authentic devotion of our hearts and the way we respond, both in our personal worship and in our corporate worship. And let's look out for each other. Let's have worship. Let's approach worship with the desire that we act as something, as someone that helps others to worship, not insisting on things being done our own way. God bless you. These are my reflections. May anything that I've said that came from God remain, and anything I've said that didn't, may it fall to the ground. Amen.